And the third level of these meanings, the highest of these meanings, is really the subject of most of the temple work that we have not yet begun. Everything that has been to this point, the three teaching cycles, all the things that have been read, the introduction to the special use of sound that we use in the temple, and of fragrance and of purifications, and the work with imperil and irritation and all these other kinds of things, have been by way of an exoteric introduction. These are all things that can be read somewhere in books, or that can be discovered in other kinds of ways, and that are held in different forms in other kinds of esoteric traditions. But the true work of the temple is a work of realizing the, one might put it this way, the third level of the teachings of the Christ. And when we speak of the Christ, we're not speaking of something related to just a Jewish man who lived and taught in Palestine 2,000 years ago. Because the Christ is the perfected, the perfection of humanity as one great corpus. The perfection of the human and the entire human expression, the entire human microcosm, the entire human kingdom as one great being lives in and constitutes the body of that Christ. And that is what Christ's humanity is. And we have this strange paradox that, just think of it in a very fleshly way, that all the spiritual aspects of all humanity constitute the body of that Christ, and yet that Christ has to be born individually within each soul and raised and nurtured and brought into full expression in the flesh. And this is not a Christian. It's not a Christian work. It does not belong to any religion, any particular religion or anything else. It is the work of the great Theosophia. It is the work of the great universal wisdom that that has come through many expressions on this planet. And we can speak of many Christed beings and many Christs who have appeared on the planet. We can speak of the one I call the Diamond Christ, Padmasambhava. There are many others that are unknown. There are many hidden Christs. There are many others. That which is Christ-like is not necessarily avataric. Christ's activity through individuality in and out of the body, the expression of the Christ in the world is very present in all kinds of places, and to some small degrees in many saints, in greater degrees in magi and great adepts, and in a very large degree to the masters of the planet and of the hierarchy that work mostly not in physical bodies. And so this work is a very great work, and it requires a vocabulary. It requires a language, an order to work more fully into, just as if one has only a simple number system of whole positive numbers, you can't launch a rocket to the moon. You can't do anything really sophisticated with just that in certain technological terms. In the same way, unless we develop a real calculus, a real calculus of that will allow us to speak the language of Theosophia, the language of the great high view that those who are most advanced among humanity have, in order to be able to communicate and understand it, and mostly in order to be able to work with that which is unseen and occult to our eyes and to our ears, requires, at the very beginning, a vocabulary. what we have done and what is I provided for you, which is the fruit of much, many years of my own work and understanding, which has not just been a simple scholarly task, because I've had to also make myself objective and impersonal with regard to church doctrines and dogmas and all kinds of other things in order to get at the historical meanings of the teachings of Jesus. This was an exercise I did as a scholar. Gave us a vocabulary. In this book called The Keys of the Master, we have some of this vocabulary explained. It's a vocabulary that is in Hebrew and Aramaic, and it includes some Greek vocabulary as well. And with that vocabulary, we have a way of grasping the deeper and higher aspects of the teachings of Master Jesus. But that vocabulary is very limited. It gives us an understanding of the context. It gives us an understanding of the relationships. It gives us a basic orientation that is very, very useful. And if people who are grounded in Jewish tradition or Christian tradition were able to understand, to use this vocabulary, they'd be able to pull themselves into a higher understanding, but it wouldn't end there. It would have to go beyond that. It is not by accident that a great magus like Paracelsus compiled a vocabulary. Compiled a vocabulary that he created himself in context with those that taught him, and that both in the invisible planes and in the visible planes, and that the earliest members of earliest Rosicrucians and people who were members of the really high occult traditions of the West put together for themselves drew from Paracelsus' vocabulary in order to create their own vocabulary. And you find that in the great esoteric traditions of the West, that the vocabularies that are used include Egyptian words, Greek words, Arabic words, and Hebrew words, and Sanskrit words. And that is because all that needs to be worked with and known and understand requires really that kind of vocabulary. One of the first things we'll be doing when we reconvene is working with the temple vocabulary, which is an abridgment, not an abridgment, it's a reworking of the vocabulary of Paracelsus, of Hebrew, Greek, Sanskrit, and Latin terms that Paracelsus himself used, and other terms that have been used, and terms that have come into usage through theosophy and other kinds of modalities, so that when we undertake the teachings and we start speaking, we can understand what is meant by an evestrum, what is meant by, when we're speaking, when we use the word that we'll probably just use English words like astral something, when we talk about astral something, that we will know what we really mean. It won't just be kind of an airy-fairy term, because there is great, it's like learning a geometry, a vocabulary, there's great, you have to know exactly what the definitions are, because these realities have been discovered in many traditions all around the world, separately and independently. They don't come from one place and then everybody's just sort of got it. Great Brahmanical tradition, the yoga traditions, the Greek mysteries. Sure, there was great intercourse between people like Pythagoras and the Brahmins and things like that. But that isn't where Pythagoras got his great teachings. It is one of the places that he received inspiration and some vocabulary. Really not very much vocabulary, just concepts. But in order to work today at the highest level that we can work, we need a vocabulary. And we need to agree upon a vocabulary. And the great start for that in the West was done through the vocabulary for the group of words that were used by Paracelsus. And starting with that as a starting point, and I will give this, each of us will then have this. This is what I call the temple vocabulary, showing the word that we will be using in terms of the terms that Paracelsus used and how they related to the terms that were used in Sanskrit and yogic thought, and then how those relate to various Hebrew and Greek terms. And there are other terms too, Egyptian terms sometimes that we'll refer to. All of that is necessary for us to have in order to be able to form a view. Because the most important, just as in Dzogchen, among the most important things you can do is form a view. We have to form a view. And our view has to be from the mountaintop. It has to be from the very highest top. We have to see everything in this way. And then, that when we have formed that view, that will be very important in the in our ability to work together on the mental and emotional planes that we will have to work together and agree upon and harmonize together in order to do the work of the temple. One of the first great work that we're going to be working with together is going to require some ripening of the root, what we call a root chakra initiation, or root chakra, not initiation, but empowerment. Root chakra empowerment. And that involves our ability to work with, to direct divine will through, and to be friends with what we call elementals. And that is not something we can do by just thinking about it. We actually have to receive an empowerment. There is an empowerment that we will transmit, that will be received. Another empowerment that there are several things we're going to work with, but ultimately each of us will require to create and maintain a special kind of protective thing, much more than amulets or any kind of traditional magical forces would be. We're not talking about working with on the level of amulets and things. We're talking about actually creating what we might call a psychic and spiritual bodyguard. I call it the lion. And this is a very important thing for each of us to have as we start this work, because a great light, when it begins to glow, attracts a great many enemies. And that will occur. We will have to be protected in that way. The first thing is deacons. The first empowerment we unfold is the empowerment that I said we use this very inadequate term, the empowerment of exorcism. But it is basically that which empowers one over inverted forces, inverted invisible forces, gives one power over these things, and therefore over fear. We could call it the empowerment of spiritual courage, as something else, and that is related also to the work with the lion. These are things that we will be doing in our working, and we will be working certain things when we do this in order to bring these into existence for ourselves and for this temple. We'll start learning how to work with this microcosm that we are. As I'm sure you're quite aware, each of us, in all of our bodies, not just the physical body, but in all of our bodies, in all of our corporate reality that we each represent, in this, of which the physical body is the root and foundation that we have to start with, in our cells and our minerals and the animal lives that we're made of, and so on. This is our instrument. This is our tool. There's nothing outside of us that is our tool or is our instrument. We learn to work to do the great work of what some people have called magic, and I'm using it in the highest sense, that of the magus. Is a work that ultimately begins with and is done through the mastery one has over one's own bodies, and there are many bodies that we each have. And we have to develop these in the New Gospel when the Master Jesus walks upon the water and calms the storm, and the disciples are in the boat. He says that first one has to master the inner nature, the interior nature, before one can begin to become a master of the exterior nature, of the outer. And this mastery is not yogic mastery. It's not simply controlling sympathetic and parasympathetic nerve response and things like this. But there are ways that it is attained, and it is also attained through insemination. It's attained through empowerment. And again, we're not talking about any kind of personal power. This temple is a group. It's a group of people, just as an orchestra is a group of people. And in this temple, as we add members to this temple, they will be added by who they are and what they are, and they will be brought to us and fitted into us by who they are and what they are through a process that will be not just a simple process. And this group will eventually hold all the elements, all the emotional elements, all the intellectual elements, all the physical elements, all the elements of vital force, and all this. And this group will be able to function collegially as a great, great light, and be able to perform great service to humanity and the planet, and to this very special alchemistical period that we are in the transmutation of members of the what we call the fifth life force or fifth root race into the sixth, that we ourselves are doing in our own bodies. And these, in all this, and this great mystical work that is being, that must be done and is being done now, that we'll be participating in as Templars, in this work lies the very high and third level of the universal and theosophical and anthroposophical teachings of the Master Jesus and of all the Masters. And it is the teaching of where we are and what we're doing and what we're knowing and how we're growing right now. That is the great, great interpretation of this. And it is not unrelated. It's not a break from the past. It's not something that's totally new, but it's a new as an octave is new. It relates as in octaves and harmonies to that which has been before. We are not, as Templars, trying to develop our individual power. We're not trying to become personalities, occult personalities. We're not interested in anything that is in gain, in or perceived as gain or as taking from oneself. We become totally givers. We become totally servers to the divine will in the world in the greatest occult sense and through the greatest means that's possible for us in the kinds of bodies we have now to actually perform. And we are living at a time of great, time of convergence, of great currents. And I should say also this, that this kind of work is ultimately neither pleasurable nor agonizing. It's it is always satisfying to do important work and to do it well. But it can involve a great interior sacrifice, sometimes great interior suffering, and the touching and confronting of areas of one's mental and emotional and physical body that that can be a great deal of burden and a great deal of pain and a great deal of sacrifice. Now, of course, if you're a young man and the person standing next to you is a very attractive young woman, there's no way that you're going to be able to make a real contact with this person, because the kinds of dreams and myths that are going to be going on within you, everything from your insecurities to your wildest carnal dreams, are going to be interfering totally with you. And that is why very often very beautiful women are starved for real contact with real human beings. But if the person is an old person, then the young person will think, "Ugh, some old fart. I want to just avoid this person. I don't want to hear, you know, how nice Ronald Reagan is," or something like that. And so these assumptions are made. But sometimes the most interesting people and the most important contacts you can make are old, ugly, disabled people. People who are the least interesting people. Or some little Chicano woman with funny little black pits all over her face and things like that. And she's standing there. And you can make a contact with that person, and you can initiate the contact with that person. You are initiating karma when you do that. And you learn something from that person, and she learns something from you, and you make an exchange. It's an exchange of many things. It's an etheric exchange, it's an astral exchange, it's an intellectual exchange, it's a psychic exchange, and you both come away enriched. That is what our work is on this planet, to make these exchanges. But we don't do that, because it's something that requires generosity. And we don't like to give up what we have. We don't know it on the conscious level, but we actually give something away when we do that, and we receive something in return. And that kind of exchange is something that most people avoid. They avoid for all kinds of reasons. The only exchanges that people want to make are exchanges where they feel like they're getting something. And that ultimately becomes the basis of human the repressive forces in society that want to take things from people, whether it's rape, whether it's robbery, whether it's ruling over other people with one's will. These are non-exchanges. These are against divine law, these kinds of things. And they are much more against divine law than we ever realized. One of the great, a man who could have been a very great poet, was a man named Coleridge. He was discouraged from being a poet by Byron and Shelley, who were his comrades, who I suspect were jealous of him. And he was going to write a poem in common with, I believe it was with Shelley, that was going to be about an ancient mariner. And he ended up writing it himself. And the other romantic poets of his circle didn't like it at all, considered to be rough and crude, and they didn't, you know. And he actually ended up not being a poet. He wrote some of the finest, most classic English poetry for a very short period in his life, and then was so discouraged by these other people that he quit being a poet, and he did some other very spectacular things. But the Rime of the Ancient Mariner tells a story of a sailor on a ship that is visited by an albatross, who's considered to be a sign of grace and blessing and good luck. And because when the albatross comes, they run into fog and some snow and things like that, he takes his arrow and he shoots and kills the albatross, for which he is praised by the other people on the crew. And then suddenly, terrible things happen. All the crew is struck dead except him, and the albatross is placed around his neck, and the ship is blown all over the oceans of the world, and he has committed the most heinous crime in the universe. It's far worse than killing Christ. It's the most heinous crime in the universe. he has to make amends for this crime. And he is punished by the spirit of the South and of the North and of the East and of the West. There's a tremendous amount of occult Rosicrucian knowledge that goes into this poem. Coleridge was steeped in some very deep stuff, just as Blake was, and so on. And if one were to read it, one would be just amazed at what is in this poem. And finally, at a certain point, they're in the doldrums. The ship is in the doldrums. All the crew is dead. Their spirits are in agony. The ghosts are in agony. And other kinds of beings are going around. And the mariner is in a state of almost a coma. And when he sees living creatures in the form of the most poisonous of the creatures on the earth, which are the sea snakes, and they are called, he calls them the fire snakes, and they're swarming around in the seas around him. And in his heart comes a feeling that he hasn't felt ever before, and it's a feeling of compassion for these living creatures, even though they are snakes, and they are the most poisonous of all snakes. And the minute that feeling comes out of his heart, this compassion for these living creatures, immediately at that point, the spell is broken. The spell of the curse itself for the killing of the albatross is broken. The man then sails through many experiences, and finally his karma for the rest of his life would get so filthy, sort of like the wandering Jew, he's going to live forever, and his job is to go around, wander the world, and when he finds the right person, tell him the story of the killing of the albatross and of the atonement for that killing, and then wander a long time and find another person and tell a story and so on. It's a very important story because it has a deep insight into the real nature of reality. Because if we're really engaged with and understand what we are doing, it's a poem about the separation of humanity from nature, and actually from each other, human beings from each other. The total separation of people. One cannot take a weapon and kill an animal with it for no reason. Not for food, not for clothing, not for self-defense, but just to kill. One cannot do a thing like that unless one is very, very, very distanced from that form of life. I remember when I was a young boy, I was about 9 or 10 years old, I had a BB gun. And they were up roosting in a little birdhouse up on our garage. It was a little family of robins, and they came back there every year. And one day, just thoughtlessly and mindlessly, and the birds were quite far away, they were probably about 80 feet away from me, I thought, I wonder if I can hit one of these birds with a BB gun, thinking that, well, it would kill them, you know, or anything like that. It might just, the BB's not that hard. And I shot the male bird, and he fell down dead. If you want to know, I felt like the Ancient Mariner at that time. I was absolutely, the pain of what I had done, the reality of what I had done, and then to wonder to myself, why did I do that? And that is what most people come to after they commit what we call crimes. Even people that murder people and cut the bodies up and eat the hearts and do all these other crazy things, that come to a point afterwards where they say, how could I do that? Why did I do that? I don't understand. And this is what the Ancient Mariner tells us about. It's about the why did we do that? Why did we do the things in the past? Why do we do things? Why do we do these mindless things, these stupid things, these things that do not look into the future, these things that are disconnected, separated things? Well, maybe we do it for the same reason that the schizophrenic person, when he finally starts to get better, takes a cigarette and burns his own skin and starts to be able to feel something. Schizophrenia is the ultimate non-feeling psychic disease. And when schizophrenics start to get better, they take knives and they take cigarettes and they start burning their skin because they're feeling something. And human beings are so divorced, we are so divorced from our feelings, even those of us that are very healthy and normal, supposedly. If we look back at what ancient generations, the Romans and other people, did to themselves and to other human beings, we say, oh, that's barbaric. But someday we'll look back at what we do in our daily lives today and we'll say, oh my God, that's barbaric. Because what we are doing is we're living in a modality that is divorced from the perception of reality as it is. And reality is perceived not by the mind. The mind is part of the illusion. Reality is perceived by the heart and by the feeling that one makes and one connects with. And that's how one connects with another human being. That's how one connects with nature. That's how one connects with another animal. And that's how one connects with one's own interior self.
To discover, establish, and maintain divine communion, to provide it for oneself, to bring it down into one's own body, one's own cells, speech, action, behavior, to provide it for others as a member of the Grail priesthood, and to make a consequential difference in the work and service that you do in this incarnate manifestation, to bring that reality onto this plane of earth. That is the work of the Grail. If you're drawn to this, I'd encourage you to take the application form that's on the Home Temple website, hometemple.org, where the THG material is, or in the back of the book on the Grail Mysteries, and to submit that. That will be an application that is good for both Home Temple and THG. And if you are drawn to this material, I would strongly advise you to become a candidate for this. You will be able to order and receive more materials to prepare you for your initiatic vigil. And I wish you well with all this.